Good evening, friends. Welcome back to the front porch. My name is Dennis Rogers, and I am joined by Michael Daniels. How's it going, Mike? How was your alternate Monday?
Fantastic, Dennis. Absolutely wonderful. I mean, I've been sick this week, so it's wonderful because I'm getting better. Yeah, I mean, it's weird. The weather here in Midwest, or just America, I guess, has been a weird thing with like almost 70 degrees, and I was sick, so I never got to go outside for any of that. And then a storm went through, as it does, and then behind it, just freezing cold.
Yeah, very cold front. I mean, I went up to Bloomington, so I don't know, was I here last week? I don't remember. It's all a blur. I wasn't. I got here Sunday. So I am back in southern Indiana at my parents' place outside Bedford. And I drove up to Bloomington on Tuesday for game night. I played your spot in Ticket to Ride Legends
of the West. Because I was sick, right?
Yeah. Because you were sick. And it was nice during the day. It was almost a little too warm. I almost, for a minute, thought about turning on my air conditioner. I was like, this is wild, because I know there was snow here before I got here.
Yeah.
And then in the evening, it had that, like, I don't know. I mean, I know that this was because of the storm front, but there also could have been an element of, I'm not used to it still being warm at night. Because in parts of the country that are very well suited to agriculture, right? Crops and pasture animals and stuff like that. Yeah. There's more moisture, right? There's more moisture in the soil. Moisture, right. And apologies to people who don't like the word moisture. Humidity, right? Humidity in the air. I don't know what better to use word to use for a soil than moisture. Damp makes it sound like a swamp. Anyway, more humidity in the air. Which means I'm not a weatherologist, but holds the heat from the day, the humidity in the air holds the heat of the day longer into the evening. Where
right, yes.
I have been for most of the past 6 months plus in very dry parts of the country. A decent amount of time on the far west side of Washington, where it's more, not quite, I wasn't really in the rainforesty parts, but very foresty. I took some pictures of the place because it kind of looked like the forest moon of Endor.
Yeah. It is. I mean,
from like September, November on, September, I skipped a month, October, November on, I have been in, like, California, Nevada, Arizona, and then last week in Texas, where it's very dry. And what that means is, even if it gets warm during the day, it cools off at night. All of which to say, when I left Trotsky's and came back down here, it was still 70 outside. And it was like midnight. I'm like, this is weird. And there's also a, like, change in barometric pressure or whatever that you can sort of feel. Some people are more sensitive to it than others. They'll have, like, you know, a joint that starts a knee or something that'll start acting up when the pressure changes. And that means there's a storm. There was a tornado watch through most of the counties in southern Indiana until like 6 a.m. Wednesday. And I was like, boy, I hope they don't upgrade that to a tornado warning while I'm here in a camper. There is a house, right, on the property.
Yeah,
so
terrible.
So I have a backup. You know, it's better for that to happen here than most places that I'm normally.
There's a reason why you don't camp regularly in Tornado Alley, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess they probably just don't build campgrounds in those places. I don't consciously avoid it. I just that they're, you know, not where the parks are.
There's a reason,
And I woke up a couple of times in the night, like sweating because it was so warm, and I had closed my windows because the wind was so strong. Yeah. And then sometime around like 4, I want to say like 4 a.m. to 6 a.m., the temp dropped from 65 down to 35 in the span of just a couple hours.
Yeah.
And ever since then, it's been cold, like not getting above like 40 during the day.
Well,
it's still February. So that makes more sense than 70 degree days.
Well, that up and down is what kind of, I think, has made me sick. Dry, that, you know, gets dry, then moisture, and it's just a lot of stuff. So I've been sick because of that. But overall, it's been a pretty good week. I got to do pre-sickness, right before the sickness, I got to do a lot of movie watching, which has been really good. I got to see Dune 2 on the fan favorite nights at AMC. It was like a week early before release. And I don't want to talk about it, which I'd love to talk about it, but you haven't seen it yet, so I don't want to even say much about it.
Right.
Except that I will report, I absolutely love it. I don't think it's hidden. That's on the internet. I'm extolling that everywhere. And everyone that I went with absolutely loved it. And they weren't necessarily like Dune fanatics.
Mm-hmm.
But I think afterwards they were sold on all of it as a kind of a film. If you're watching this and you're wondering, do I want to go through it? And I had mixed feelings about the first one, which I can kind of understand. Not mixed feelings. It's just that it's a big, complicated story that doesn't end really in the first one.
Mm-hmm.
So you spend, 3 hours in that movie with this gorgeous cinematography and beautiful movie, but you're just not sure what the story is trying to get at or do things. I would say is the general consensus on some dissenters in the first film. That's kind of answered in this one because it really truly feels like this is actually just one 6-hour movie. And I don't mean that anyway, because it just feels like that first one doesn't end and it was just a pause. We went to the restroom, came back, and now we're starting into this one.
Yeah. You know? I mean, that was part of my complaint about the part one thing. Like, it's not the things we call trilogies from years past, right? Like Back to the Future, Star Wars, Indiana Jones, even The Godfather. You're like, these are three movies, and in some cases, they're a sort of continuing story, right? Like the events of the first three Star Wars sort of flow together. Clearly not the plan from the outset, but, you know, became that. And a little bit with Back to the Future, though it's hard to tell because Back to the Future has a repetitive motif. Like, that's it's like a major theme of that movie is that, you know, time repeats itself. So it's like, yeah, the second one is kind of the same story as the first one, but that's to be expected.
Well, and a lot of these kind of films, when they break them up, or let's say something like Lord of the Rings, it was written as one book, the Lord of the Rings was, and then the publisher had him chop it up into pieces.
Right.
And he chopped it up in the same way that filmmakers chop things up today on multiple trilogies. Well, it depends. On a trilogy that's one story, they chop it up so that the viewer can kind of feel like they got some kind of story told to them, not quite a beginning and middle end, but they try to in a viewing. That way they feel form of completion, but a desire to continue the journey, right? What's actually next? Oftentimes that's what we do. And when we speak of something like Lord of the Rings, he's got to get this ring all the way to Elrond. That's kind of the whole point, is getting it to the elves, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the story. We learn about the characters and we find the characters and we go on this journey, and the goal is to get it to them so that they can find out what to do. And they complete that. And then they go a little bit further and like, you got to go all the way to Doom. And they're like, oh crap. So you see some points where they're getting to the points, and you feel, I think it ends after a little bit after Moria, if I'm right. And they, when you're done with like Lord of the Rings, the first part, you feel like you've gotten something there. You've come to an end, like the Fellowship breaks, right? And then you're okay, now it's, whatever's going to happen now is totally different than what we've had before, but we feel like we've gotten that completion. With Dune, part one, you didn't really have anything. There was no real completion. It really wasn't, right?
Right.
Without spoilers, this is an open thing that, like, I don't know.
And then knowing, and we talked about all this kind of at the time, because it's been a couple of years since the first movie, like, the Lord of the Rings films, and I know we praise these movies every time we talk about any topic that even remotely relates, but they filmed the three movies at the same time. I mean, obviously not literally simultaneously, but they made them all. And, you know, I mean, it's a decent comparison, because this is also an adaptation from books. It's not a new idea like Back to the Future or Star Wars or whatever. Like, there's source material. Like, they could, and of course, it's a bigger, investment for the studios and whatever. But Peter Jackson filming the Lord of the Rings trilogy, you know, back to back or kind of all at the same time, let them release them just a year apart, right? 3 years in a row around Christmas.
Right.
And so there's time, you know, there's time in between, but not so much time that people forget like what happened in the previous film.
It's just 1 year. I think they were.
Yeah. And now, I mean, the comparison is a little different for me, because I watched Dune at home on TV in the same day that I watched the last James Bond movie that was also like 3 hours long. And so I was just like bored on my phone waiting, because I knew that it kind of cuts off without resolving. So I kept waiting for that to come. I'm like, is this where it ends? No. Okay. He's going to sleep in a tent with his mom for a while. Okay. No. Still.
Yeah.
This is happening. Okay. Whatever. And I mean, I literally can tell you nothing about that first movie except Jason Momoa is in it and Zendaya.
And barely, right? She's barely in it there. Well, the
so I either need to rewatch the first movie before I go see the new one.
I would recommend that, just because it is like going right into it, you know.
Yeah, or get on YouTube and watch a recap.
Maybe. Maybe. I actually enjoyed the first movie a lot, so I've rewatched it, I think, three times since then. People know I'm a rewatcher.
Sure.
At least I've seen it that many times. And the difference between how the characters evolved between these two films are really big, and really, especially the main protagonist. And now when I go back and just watch even stills from the first movie, I'm like, wow, he just looks so young and naive and unconditioned, whatever. Even it's just, and now when you watch part two, holy cow, Chalamet just has a different character performance. And because literally his character is forced to grow through every step in all the parts in a very normal, natural, not normal, but forced way. And Chalamet just really kills it with that. So, and that's, if you watch the first one, that gives you perspective when you're watching the second one. Like, wow, this is just, this character has really come a long way, right?
Sure.
So, yeah, I said this for the first time, and I'll say it again, and there isn't a review I've read that has not said this, is that you really, really have to see this in the theater. It feels like a cardinal sin not to watch, especially this one, in the theater. If you can watch it on the biggest screen possible with the best sound possible, please do. You're never going to have an experience like this again. It just really is. You could just have no words and just listen to the score, which is Hans Zimmer. I'm telling you, it's Hans Zimmer. Mm-hmm. And that guy is amazing. And he, once again, he shows you why that name is going to be a legendary first round Hall of Famer person, because it's incredible. And you just hear it in these vistas. And even at this gigantic, it feels like every shot is just bursting and it's going to burst out of the frame. It's so big. And you're like, you know, how does it contain this? And obviously the worms are a perfect example. And when the worms come on screen, you're like, oh my God, it's so enormous. And then another one comes in and you're like, how is this fitting on the screen type thing? And I can't imagine watching that on a small kind of screen. That's just beyond me. So yes, this is the example of why we go to theaters. It really is. And the difference between that.
Sure.
Dune Part 2 is excellently, should win awards for cinematography, sound, music, costume design. I think I'm not a real huge fan of Chalamet. I think he was incredible. And some of that also with sound design and editing. I can just feel the team. I'm really happy that I've learned so much in the last 5 to 10 years about cinema and film. And have a lot of exposure to it, if not at the minimum because of this podcast, to recognize when, you know, say Chalamet's character, Paul, walks forward and he's speaking to a crowd and he, all of a sudden his presence, because he's speaking to them and he's trying to like intimidate or be strength, show strength. I can note that he's walking towards the camera and he's leaning in, and then there's some kind of sound amplification in underneath his voice that the sound editor has put like more bass in or something to make him feel more commanding. And I'm like, man,
right. Yeah,
everyone's doing their part here. Chalamet's acting, the director's putting him in that spot. The camera is zooming in as he's going through. Everyone's doing a job to make the emotion happen. And that's in one shot. And they're doing it in every scene. It's crazy how it comes together.
One of the few things I remember from the David Lynch.
Yep, David Lynch.
Film is there like some kind of shouting and shooting magic they use toward the end of the story.
I thought that was cool when I was a kid. I thought that was one of the neatest things about the movie. Let me tell you a little spoiler. That's not in this at all. And I don't know why. Like they just he just didn't like it, I guess. So it's fair. It's not vital.
Speaking of Hans Zimmer, I had to double check this so I don't, you know, talk out of turn. He's won 2 Oscars for original score. One was for the Part 1 of Dune, and the other was for The Lion King. We were talking about.
I thought it would have been for Gladiator. Wow.
Gladiator is in the list. I don't know who I'm sure it was nominated. There might have been something else that year. But I assume you've seen those videos, like TikTok and whatever, where the guys are like making the movie. They do this for a bunch of things, right? They do it with Phil Collins and Tarzan. And a couple others. But for Lion King, they'll do the music at the end, right? Spoiler, Simba's climbing up Pride Rock and the music, just the choir, like it gets really like crescendo, and then it'll come back down a little bit, and there's all the drums and the sing, you know, the other voices and stuff, and then it hits another crescendo and it's just so big, the music. And in the videos they're always like, you know, the camera shaking, the one guy's crying and he doesn't know why.
It's
pretty great.
Those are, Hans Zimmer does that kind of emotional thing that is unique to a generation, if not generations. Him and John Williams are people to be awed over, that we live in their lifetime is precious, and we should remember that. Dune Part 2, and I'm praising Chalamet here, but he is one on a cast of many who are phenomenal for every one of their roles that they play perfectly to what they need to do. I want to shout out, as they say, to I'm going to say his name is Denis Villeneuve, and every time I hear his name, I keep wanting to do a new thing to respect him and start calling you Denis Rogers, because that's pretty, the dude's cool as heck. And I'm like, but his name's spelled just like yours.
Yeah, I think he has just one N, but it's,
yeah, oh, does he? Okay.
That's the French not original. Like the original name is Greek, Roman. I think it's Roman.
Greco-Roman?
Dionysus. The Greek version is Bacchus, I think, unless I have those backwards.
Got it.
The god of wine and partying and
all
of that stuff. But most recently, like, Dennis is the anglicized version of the French name Denis.
Well, he's so cool. I mean, I don't even know. I haven't watched any interviews or anything with the guy. I just, watching these films, I just feel his presence in this. So I want to convey that and tie that together with what we had said about the story and the storytelling. This director and write, he didn't write it, but, you know, he helped with the screenplay, adaptive screenplay. This guy has clearly a passion for this story and loves it and wants to tell it, and had a clear, when we say vision, we say like, oh, we kind of take that, use that often as flippantly. This is a guy who saw this, probably dreamed about it, wrote things on his own and had drawings of his own before he ever came into this as a passion project, because when he made part one, he did not have funding for part two. He did not have a green light. They did not say, oh yeah, you can do this. You know, they gave him a lot of money, which is great. But they weren't guaranteeing anything else. They also put it directly on, I think they released it the exact same time on HBO Max. So that's when they were doing that kind of thing, or no, they were going to, and he threw a fit or something, and wouldn't allow it. But the studio didn't put a lot of support beyond money behind this. And even then, he did not write, direct, and make that first movie as a vehicle to get more funding for the second movie. He wrote it as it's going to be just part one of part three. And he just continued that, uncaring whether, you know, it follows the logic of Hollywood executive producers to make it beginning, middle, and end, and then all that kind of stuff I was talking about. He made this as a, we're going to stop here because it's the part in the timeline when we stop. And he does the same thing with part two. Part two does kind of have a feeling like if they don't make a third, it could end, because it's basically the David Lynch story. It ends kind of in the same spot that David Lynch one ends. But you definitely, unlike the David Lynch one, this one, there's a part at the end where you're like, oh, this goes on. This isn't over. And he wants to make Dune Messiah. And again, they have not greenlit it yet until it succeeds. But man, I just so much appreciate the auteur of this guy to come and say, no, I'm going to make this movie. And if it doesn't succeed, it's because my vision isn't worth it. But I really do believe that my vision is worth it. And he is right.
Yeah, it's a sign of how, like, risk averse production studios are now. I don't know if production studios is the right term right there, but, you know, everything is like the safest, most bland, middle of the road. And I'm being a little hyperbolic, but I feel like Denis Villeneuve should have had enough clout to get a deal for two movies when he started after Blade Runner. 2049. Yeah. Like, that movie wasn't perfect, but it was much more comprehensible than the original, and didn't need like five director's cuts to get it right.
I mean, I get that. I get some things in Hollywood where there's two parts where like some directors are really good, and then say M. Night Shyamalan, for example, and then they'll give them a big budget for another movie, and it's just bomb after bomb after that. So maybe it's not necessarily a flash in the pan, but he's got one or two good movies and the rest aren't great, and that makes them lose a ton of money. I get that. And there's the also thing that they are investing a ton, so they it's scary when they take a chance and give a guy a bunch of thing and carte blanche, and then they're paying millions. I can understand that.
Yeah, I mean, it'll probably be a while before the director of Madam Web gets a gets a big project.
Right. That said, you just mentioned Denis Villeneuve after 2049. You should see this guy like, oh, he's worth giving that kind of cred. Another one, there's a few of those in Hollywood. The other people I would say is the Russo brothers. I think the Russo brothers,
right?
You give them money and you just trust in their thing in the same way that Martin Scorsese did stuff. Like he didn't ask. He just went to the studio and said, I'm going to make this movie that I'm going to do. And they're like, okay, here's money. You do it. No oversight. It's all you type thing. And that's how the Russos should be. And I think Denis Villeneuve should be able to do stuff. So yeah, I spent too long praising this movie without talking about the movie, but that's fine. Just, you know, please go out and don't miss this opportunity. Not because, you know, oh, I think you'll have a great time. I think you'll miss an experience that in the theater. And, you know, you can go back and say whether you do or don't like sci-fi high fantasy, you can say, man, that's an example of why I used to go to the movies. Sure. I don't go all the time because 90% of the movies aren't this. Let's say 95% of the movies. But this is the one that's worth it. And especially, it's even worth it in IMAX, I would say, paying that extra money. Okay, Dune, that was a lot for that. Apologize. So before we go on to some other things that we have, let's hit our movie. What do you say?
Sure. All right, this week we watched Bank of Dave from last year, 2023. I don't know if there are too many people in this you would recognize. They're all English actors. Hugh Bonneville is in this. He was in Downton Abbey.
Wait, you don't recognize Def Leppard?
Of course, Def Leppard. no, I did not recognize them.
That's true. That's true. They're like 60
from their appearance. Right. Phoebe Denevor, I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. She was in Bridgerton, the Netflix costume drama that has sex in it.
Is that the lady who was trying to get the hospital together? Is that
the doctor character?
Okay.
And I feel like I've seen Rory Kinnear in other stuff. He was in some Bond movies. He was in Quantum of Solace and Skyfall.
Dave, yeah, right, yeah. He works for M, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
This is your pick, and I messaged you saying I'm not totally shocked, but I was like, you picked the feel good movie because all the way through this is a straight up feel good movie.
As I mentioned last week, this is a film my mom told me about. They watched it and were like, not only you should watch this, but you should watch this for the podcast. It'll be interesting discussion. And so I knew that it was going to be, you know, wholesome and heartwarming. That's the kind of stuff that my mom watches.
I wanted to say that I didn't mean that as like a knock on you that you don't pick heartwarming movies, because we've watched several of yours that you have. And I hadn't heard of it before, so I expected it to be some niche, weird kind of thing. I hadn't either.
It kind of flew under the radar, and it's definitely, if you've been listening to the podcast for a long time, I tend to pick, not always, you know, sometimes I'll pick mediocre kids movies from my childhood and we'll find out they don't hold up or whatever.
Or they're great, you know.
But between the two of us, I'm more likely to pick something obscure and maybe a little quote-unquote challenging.
I was thinking that same word, challenging.
Make interesting
conversation.
Yeah.
So this one... I, on the other hand, am one that tends to pick overly saccharine things and that don't have necessarily a lot of substance, but it feels good. And that's totally fine. But this one obviously rung my bell for what I like. And I did. I was expecting the other shoe to fall some point near the beginning, like, oh, Dave seems too nice, or this seems too good of a thing to happen. There's no real villain. There's kind of a villain, but it's not real bad. And when it didn't, after 10 minutes, I'm like, okay, this is cool. I'm happy. And I like this. And I enjoy the story. They set it up real straight up early. What's going to happen, right? In the like preface before they even say Bank of Dave. And I was like, oh, cool. I'm on board with this. And it's kind of a semi real story. I liked it all the way through, from the beginning and the middle and the end, and all the little trials that they went through, and how Dave is, constantly positive, right? And never really gets too down. And even in he does a lot of lines like, I know I'm going to lose, and I know that, you know, I'm going to lose a lot of money on this, but I want them to come out and admit that they're not working for us, or that kind of thing, or they're doing it to the public. And everything that Dave kept, this character kept doing throughout the whole film. And I wouldn't even say Dave is the main character, to be honest.
No, he's not.
But everything Dave did throughout, felt genuine and true. And he never wavered from that. And I like those characters. I've always been a fan of like paladins or that kind of thing when I was a young kid, or knights in shining armor and that kind of stuff. And it's the, you'll keep your honor all the way through no matter what type stuff. And yeah. Dave felt like that kind of character to me. And it was nice, and its completion, that he was that character. And the writers never let that go. And for the most part, almost everyone was in here, with the exception of the antagonist villain, Banks. Right. Air quote, Banks of bad guys.
They said the Royal Banking Board, whatever, the organization that manages the banks in England. It was interesting, because obviously I was not familiar with the English version of the banking crisis. I assume talking about the 08 crisis, and it's very similar to what happened here. Without getting too political, from a practical standpoint, it makes sense that the government had to step in and help those banks, keep it from failing, right? That's why we have things like the FDIC to try and prevent something like the crash in 29. I think it was 29, right? The Great Depression, as we say.
And we're not British, you and I, so we are not familiar with
that situation. No, we were not following, but it sounds like what happened over there was very similar to what happened here, despite, you know, everything like politically and whatever being very different between our two governments. And I shouldn't say very different. Like they're a democratic monarchy, where, you know, we're a democratic republic or whatever you say. So the actual function, like even though they have a monarch, even though they have a king and had a queen for 70 years or whatever, the actual like day-to-day functioning is probably not that different. Sure. Except that we have things like credit unions and small banks, that it sounds like they don't or didn't have, over there. The idea that they'd had no new banks in 150 years, when I know that we have new banks. So
all the time.
That part was different.
That was something that I also didn't know. So I'm really glad you brought that up, because as watching this thing, I kept thinking, oh, wow, this is like almost an educational piece from a foreigner myself into the British thing. You know, they're hundreds and hundreds of years older than us. Their country is, if not maybe 1,000, I'm not really sure. So they have history more than us, to that kind of stuff. And whereas we may sometimes feel like the Wild West with some of our systems, you know, there's our systems in 500 years, maybe established type stuff, where, you know, there's no longer any banks and we've settled on the five that we want. I'm like, oh, that really happened. I can see that in an English environment. So, Yeah. And then I could also see modern people wanting to stand up and fight against that, which
right.
Dave was doing.
I guess I didn't finish my thought about the bank crisis and the bailout. Like, you know, it's bad that the banks, you know, sort of crashed, but it would have been worse if they had completely crashed, if the government had not stepped in. The unfortunate side effect of that, that I don't know, is a whole different political conversation about how could you have prevented this aspect of it, was that the executives at those banks benefited from that bailout, right, and got bonuses and whatever kind of, like, I think that mostly happened here the way that it in this film is described as happening over there.
Right.
And yeah, I mean, as far as a movie, like this movie as a movie, because it's, what would you say? I think this sort of genre is sometimes described as creative nonfiction, or,
yeah, fair. That's
or in film, we might call it like a docudrama or something.
Sure.
Where they take true events, but, you know, add in some fictional characters, or like the series Chernobyl.
Uh-huh.
Right, created fictional scientists and, you know, had one or two characters do something that historically was probably 100, 150 different people, you know, doing different things. But, like, make it one character because it's a disaster movie, and so you have a... it's a series, not a movie, but it's written like a disaster movie where there's, you know, one or two good guys, like, really chasing down the truth kind of thing, right? It's Jeff Goldblum in Independence Day or whatever.
Right.
Where this movie is very much like it's like a holiday rom-com in a lot of ways.
Good description.
There's no holiday, but you have that exact formula of the main character is a big city guy who's not really satisfied with his life in the big city and goes to this small town. I think, as far as the actual Dave, because it's a real guy, I saw, you know, some of his YouTube interviews, and it's a lot like, the character in the movie.
I did some reading afterwards.
Yeah, as well. I watched some of those videos, and they're like, and he's like, you know, they found, you know, they got Rory Kinnear. He looks more like me than I do, which is funny, funny kind of. But he had the same, like, you know, his personality was accurately portrayed in the movie. But it mostly follows this lawyer, and I assume that he, you know, the real Dave did the same kind of thing where he hired a good law firm to represent him in this endeavor and all this stuff. But, you know, they gave the lawyer character a lot of personality. It follows him. He meets this girl and, you know, spoiler for the, and decides to stay there. And they changed the name, right? The real bank is called the Burnley Savings and Loan, I think. Just to, like, we have savings and loans. I don't think we have many of those anymore. Now they're called credit unions, but...
Because it's not actually a bank. Like, they didn't actually get to be made a bank.
Right. It's not a Bank of Dave. But it's exactly, you know, what he describes, what he lays out in the movie. You know, people,
right,
you know, put their money in the bank, right? Like a savings account. And, which is, I keep saying credit unions. I'm not a banker. I know very little about finance. I sort of assume that credit unions operate in a similar way, where people put their money in and the bank uses that money to give out loans. And in this case, in the movie, as well as in real life, any profits that the Burnley savings and loan makes above its operating costs and all that is not, you know, invested in other things and over leveraged and whatever, like happened in the recession, but is donated to charity, just like it says in the movie.
Yeah. I like the comparison to the holiday rom-com, because my overall opinion on this, as we kind of roll into the wrap-up part, it's not a challenging film. It's not one that's going to be like make you think, or you know, some twists or turns and things like that. There's a small romance type stuff in it. It's got a little bit of things. It's not like movie of the year. It's not like crazy great performances, but it definitely has feel good all the way written through it. It has positivity written all the way through it. And it never lets you get too down in things, even though it has some challenging moments, whether, you know, it's, if it's not going to fail or things like that, enough to make you feel like, oh, how are they going to get through that kind of thing? And at the end of the day, all those things that I said, positivity and hopefulness and, you know, goodness, I like those things. Those are my favorite things. So I enjoy this the same way I do also enjoy good holiday rom-coms. They just make me feel good. I like watching them. And I'm very happy that I spent the time watching Bank of Dave. And I would not have seen that or known about it or anything else. I actually kind of liked the whole learning about the British banking system. You didn't learn a lot about the British banking system,
No. But
you get an idea into what that world over there is a little bit like, enough right. That I kind of wanted to read a little bit about it.
Yeah.
So that's me. Overall, how'd you feel about watching your time at Bank of Dave?
Yeah, it was good. It's, you know, again, like as a movie, as you know, it has a very, like sweet and kind of everything works out kind of plot, but the fact that it's, you know, based on a true story, and a lot of based on true story films are boring or disjointed or depressing.
Yeah.
Or just very like, you know, this one guy was a real guy and everything else is made up, right? Like, like RRR, right?
Sure.
Those two characters were real people, but they never met. They weren't best bros who had dance offs
right.
and
best bros
and fought the British with their bare hands. I mean, maybe they did. I don't know, but not together anyway.
Right.
And shoot magic flaming arrows and stuff. I mean, I think the I don't want to say redeeming, but like the best thing to recommend about this movie is that the like saccharine feel good vibe of the plot is because it's a real thing that really happened. This guy
right.
took on the British banking system and won. That's you know, heartwarming, I guess. I don't know.
I agree.
How else to describe it.
Well, we're not going to go do another movie this week for our listeners who are usually following along with us. It's kind of a weird break that we almost haven't done in the last 4 years or so. But we have a short recording week this week, and we're rolling right into our big yearly gaming convention at ICGCon. And you and I are going to spend the next 3 days, three days, just crazy gaming, 24 hours. And then we record our next episode right after that. So there won't be any time for us in there. We might be able to squeeze something in the middle, but it'd be forced. And we'd rather come back on Monday and report on all these great games we're going to be playing and the good time we'll have instead of forcing in a film. So we're going to go ahead and skip it this week. Who knows? We may double up at some point to right that ship, but I think we're okay. Right?
Yeah.
So we did watch another one. I don't know how much time we want to talk about this one because it's a weird thing. I got a couple questions about you for it. I went and watched, I mentioned before, I'm on the AMC A-list subscription thing where I can get three movies in a week. So there's if I have an opportunity to watch a movie, and I will go watch it, right? And just come in and have some popcorn. Sometimes that random watch turns into like nightmare in the case of Madam Web. But other times I watch a show like I did, which was Anyone But You, and it was okay. So I said I watched that one with Sydney Sweeney, and I can't remember the guy's name. It's driving me crazy. He's from Top Gun.
Glenn Powell.
Yeah. And then you said, oh, you'll go watch that one too. So let's talk about Anyone But You, that has been out for a while, and then it came back into to theaters for like a Valentine's Day rerun or something, and still was in. This is, I kept saying in my chats that it's just the word sexy is on every page, dripping off the page. You were shaking it off with the word sexy on every page.
Yeah.
And then at the end, there's kind of in the background, words above a baseball stadium that says Much Ado About Nothing, which is the clue that this is what this is kind of based on in a modern retelling.
Right.
And our buddy Fox, who watched this, was enamored. He's enamored with that film anyway, or that play from Shakespeare, Much About Nothing. It's a play, correct, I think. And we've watched a couple iterations on that one. And I enjoy that story, maybe not as much as Fox.
Right.
But not all of them I've enjoyed. This one, I didn't like the film a lot. But I also had this weird feeling of, am I supposed to be watching this way? Or am I supposed to be watching this like a satire? Or just kind of how I watch Transformers and don't think about it. Is it just supposed to be a sexy film with funny people that's not really funny, but it's just sophomoric intentionally? Because recently, you know, you and I have come across that where we think one thing about a film and then somebody comes and explains it to us and we're like, oh yeah, we overthought or something, you know?
Sure.
So I'm glad that you went and watched that so you can give your take to me about, you know, did I miss something or whatever? Because I was watching this and the dialogue was just really strained. Didn't feel like it made any kind of real world practical sense. Super goofy. None of the things that they were like when they were trying to trick them into getting together was just so poorly done and absurd that I felt like, is this supposed to be absurd and not right? Because it's totally implausible at every step. And so much so that even at the very beginning, when they meet each other and they spend the night together, and the next morning she walks back to his front door that goes upstairs, and he's sitting at the top of the stairs at an open door, talking loud enough that she can overhear everything. It's just so absurd and completely nonsensical, I guess, that I was like, okay, it's a bad movie. But every time Sydney Sweeney's on the screen and Glenn Powell and all these other incredibly sexy, attractive people, I'm distracted overwhelmingly enough that I forget about that. And then Fox brings the Much Ado About Nothing thing, and I'm like, okay, is this just Shakespeare? And Shakespeare, when you try to put it into a real modern thing, not well, is terrible? I don't know what to think, Dennis.
Okay.
What should I be thinking about this?
All right. Well, I'll give you the Harrison Ford quote that you've quoted at me a couple times in the last few months.
Okay.
Kid, it ain't that kind of movie.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I had heard also from our buddy Fox that this seems to be, the way he described it was, you know, written for people who love Much Ado About Nothing.
Okay.
Which is a thing people do, right? There are films that are not adaptations or remakes of Pride and Prejudice that are clearly written for people who love Pride and Prejudice. Like,
would you call that like fanfic, kind of a fanficky type thing?
Not necessarily. Like, Bridget Jones's Diary is one of those.
Okay.
It's like, it's sort of a modern retelling, but it really has very little of the structure, you know. It's not, it's more different from the Jane Austen novel than even the YouTube series, right? Okay. I am not familiar enough with Much Ado About Nothing to really see the direct comparisons, and it's been too long since we watched the Joss Whedon version. I think we still have the Kenneth Branagh version in our list somewhere that our buddy Cogswell recommended to us.
Sure.
And it's the one, I think that's the one people think of when they say, you know, the movie version of Much Ado About Nothing. But I heard that from Fox, and so I was like, okay, there's going to be some stuff here that I don't really get, that I, you know, don't necessarily. I had the same sort of distraction reaction to the cast. Glenn Powell and Sydney Sweeney are both very attractive actors.
Yeah,
and
for sure.
Most of Sydney Sweeney's costuming was very flattering, even in a cast of, you know, almost all beautiful people.
Yeah.
Most of her outfits were very intentionally chosen to emphasize her appearance.
Attributes.
Right.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Without being too objectifying.
No, and obviously she's a very attractive lady, but this one was very, very overt about it. And to be fair, they were that same with Glenn Powell. He's a stunningly gorgeous fellow. And
yeah.
He constantly has his shirt off or tight things showing his arms. And there's other guys like that are like that in the scene, and they're taking showers.
Yeah.
And,
there's the guy they make a Hemsworth joke. Just like, he's almost set dressing. You've got Dermot Mulroney, right, who is getting up in years, but still, you know, a handsome man, played romantic leads in movies in the past.
They were straightforward with it. It wasn't a secret, right?
Right.
So I'm glad you said it's not that kind of movie kid thing, because.
Yeah,
I feel better.
I think I got, kind of like, I forget what the scene was that you said. It's the song. So to go back to Love Actually, and Bill Nighy doing his song, right? His Christmas song.
That's ridiculous
and terrible. And then he's doing the interviews, and it's. Or maybe it's not even to the interviews, but it's supposed to be that, where, like, I read that scene as straight, you know, as him being miserable and he's doing this stupid thing and he hates it, and very, like, you know, straight, plausible, you know, supposed to be the real world. Where the in this movie and Anyone But You, I watched that coffee shop sequence where it's like, oh, right here at the beginning, boom, meet cute. Not just meet cute,
right,
but then the series of mishaps, comedy of errors in the bathroom, right? Which we've seen on sitcoms and other movies and kind of things. And I'm like, okay, this movie is going to be a little ridiculous.
Okay, yes, I agree with you. And at that scene, yes, I knew that too. You're right. And because... that the fact they wouldn't give her the key is absurd.
Right.
The fact
right.
that he yells out that it's my wife randomly is right. absurd. And then she does the bathroom thing. I'm like, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Something, just a brief detour here. They have a couple of jokes, and I'm curious now. I should have looked this up before I started talking about this. Doesn't say. They make jokes about, 88. And she's got to be a fair bit younger. They make jokes or references to the age gap between them.
Right? Yeah. How old is Sydney Sweeney?
He's born 88. She's born 97.
Nine years difference. Okay. So she's got to be like 20 or 21. Because he says he's 29, I guess.
He says he's 29, but he's... 30, I can't do math. This came out this year. So he's like 35 or 6.
Oh, okay. All right.
34 to 36, yeah. Whatever. I can't do math.
I couldn't tell, but you know.
And she,
I know she's kind of young, but I don't know how young. I
mean. Yeah, so 23 plus 3, 25 or 6.
Carry the 1.
Right.
Divide by 2.
About the same. What's funny about that to me is that I, in the middle of watching Bank of Dave, had to go and look up the ages of the main character, the lawyer, and the doctor. Because yeah. when she came on screen, I was like, she's a doctor? She looks like a college student at best.
Right, yeah.
They do have, I think she's like 28 or 9, that actress, and the actor playing the lawyer is like 38 or 9. There's almost exactly 10 years age difference between them.
Hollywood doing Hollywood, right.
Right, where in this case, maybe because Glenn Powell's in such good shape, like I did not see, I was like, oh, okay, I guess he's older than her. Like I didn't see it as clearly. Anyway,
but they kept doing the jokes and it didn't land because I was like, I don't get that, you know?
Yeah. He doesn't look that old. I mean, maybe he does, but, yeah. So I just rolled with this movie, right? There's about 4 or 5 times where there's text on the screen, like the sign you mentioned, Much Ado About Nothing, but there are, like, it starts, I think, on the wall, like, painted on the wall outside the coffee shop is a Shakespeare quote, and it might even be from Much Ado About Nothing. It probably is, but I don't,
yeah.
Again, I'm not familiar enough with that play to recognize those quotes.
Yeah. I appreciated the way they did those things.
Yeah, and there are several, you know, this it's like in the set of the beach house or whatever, there's a inspirational sign on the wall or something. It's just in the background. You might not notice it if you're not looking for it. And I wasn't really looking for it. So they're not like super subtle Easter eggs or anything like that.
Sure. Yeah.
And so there were several times where, you know, I laughed out loud at something. I mean, sometimes because it was legitimately funny and sometimes because it was absurd, you know, I'd laugh at something, go, that's dumb. But I'm still like smiling and, you know, sort of laughing at it. They're getting picked up by Harbor Patrol and lifted up into the helicopter. And I'm like, they're lifting them both at the same time. They didn't send an EMT down, probably not EMT. They didn't send somebody down to bring them up one at a time. It's just them together. It didn't look like they were in the harnesses the right way. And, you know, of course, maybe they're going to kiss while they're, you know, doing she's singing his Serenity song, which is also a dumb, like,
also such a dumb
how do they know my Serenity song? How do they all know my Serenity song? I'm like, this is dumb, but I'm still like laughing.
Right. Well, they do make that joke later, right? When he comes after her later, he says something like, why couldn't you just pick people up with boats? And she's like, stop, don't talk about it, like the pilot lady or whatever,
yeah,
the rescue lady. Like, it was almost a self-awareness of,
right,
we know it's, yeah, absurd, but
yeah,
that's one of those things that made me think, okay, maybe I'm not getting this, because that was self-aware, right, of this.
Yeah,
so yeah, that's, I don't know if I would recommend this to anybody, honestly. Who I would recommend it to is a very specific group of people, 16-year-old boys,
and sure,
and maybe 19 to 20-year-old girls going out on a date. And I know I'm being very sexist in both of those two things, but it feels like that's what this is made for those very specific kinds of people.
Sure, sure.
And unless you are going with this, it's overtly absurd. I do want to say that I don't think any of the actors were doing a bad job in this film.
No.
I think that the writing wasn't great, and the directing sometimes, like when you're shooting a camera shot, I'm thinking specifically when I think it's the friend and the stepdad are trying to be jokey about letting him eavesdrop on something. and they're really bad at it.
Mm-hmm.
The camera just like is a straight square shot on them, and it feels like they're on stage on a play trying to act this thing, and there's not good dialogue, and they're also supposed to be bad at doing the bad dialogue,
mm-hmm.
and it doesn't land in any way, and the direction doesn't help.
Yeah, so the friend.
That's a credit for the actors. They're not doing. They're doing best what they can with what they got, but the creativity and the writing isn't.
Yeah, there. I assume. I mean, to be generous to the movie, I assume most of that's intentional.
Yes, it very much, like Love Actually,
and yeah. I liked the stepdad character. He's I want to call him Australian Michael Caine.
Fair, sure.
That's he gave that vibe.
And the mom is Raffi
from Star Trek Picard. Yeah.
I don't have a recommendation.
If you're one of those people who says Love Actually is your favorite movie, if you love Much Ado About Nothing, but are not a Shakespeare purist, right? Like, I think if you're, you know, really big, like, English major who, you know, studies Shakespeare in your spare time, you're probably, maybe, I don't know. We'll find something that irks you about this movie. It would be something that I would recommend to my parents, except that it's so explicit.
Punchy? It's very explicit sometimes.
Too. Yeah, I mean, maybe in like a TV edit version or something. But it has a niche audience. Yeah, I'd agree with that.
Clearly. It does make me think that maybe it is time now to take that recommendation off the shelf and watch Cogswell's Much Ado recommendation. So maybe it is time to actually watch that one, and then now I can say, okay, this is correlated here, and give anyone but you a little bit more credit. But as it stands now, it's definite pass. And I'll tell you what, had it not had that dripping sexy in it, I would have maybe potentially even left the theater type situation. It just, it was enough. Okay. Moving on from that one, I'm going to run down four quick games I can do it under 3 minutes. I played Pal World. Not a lot to report there, except that I played it several times. I'm really enjoying it. You can read about the controversy of its Pokemon similarities or not. It's very much a quick review of it is that it is a base builder with some buddy animal collections that you have, and they help you in the base, and that modifies the base building part of the game greatly in a good positive way. I like the character designs, that Pokemon kind of type thing, but a little bit more adult. I definitely like it. I really would love to play it multiplayer with more people, because that feels like it's got that Valheim feel to it, where we could all be in the same world making bases and collecting our Pokemon and doing that kind of stuff. I really enjoy it so far. Core Keeper, our buddy Trotsky wanted me to play this. It's in early access. He wants to play it with us because it's he's calling it a Terraria meets Zelda game.
Okay.
I don't know. I've played it for maybe an hour, so I don't have a lot of talk about it. I may talk about it later, but all I can say is in that hour of playing it, the word early access definitely rings true.
It's got that Stardew Valley or RPG
you
Maker.
You called it.
Yes. Aesthetic.
That was my thing when he said Terraria and Zelda. My thing was like none of that. All of Stardew Valley, but not as good. Almost like early access Stardew Valley.
Hmm.
Our Stardew Valley was polished and had all these things. This is like you've got a long way to go here, buddy. Your stuff. And I only played it in an hour. I'll give it more of a chance and maybe come back at it later. But so far, definitely early access. And I'll report back to them. I played Foam Stars what's the paintball? Splatoon. It's the Splatoon challenge. It's Sony made a challenger to Splatoon for Nintendo Splatoon. But this is Foam Stars. I don't like it. I just don't. It's hard to play when you play it multiplayer. It's somebody went and had a foam party where you have these big bubbles of foam, like when you know, like at a rave or something, and it's just everywhere.
Sure.
And that's really cool. But they did that and they're like, hey, what if we had guns that could do this and we just had a big fight? And let me tell you, that's not as fun as you think it might be. And also, while the characters are cool and have a good designs and their weapons shoot out interesting foam things, playing against matches each other just becomes a big mess. It's just foam everywhere. You don't know what's hitting. Like you shoot a bullet or a laser and it has a tracer, so you know where it's going. Foam is just shooting everywhere, and all of a sudden you die. And you're like, okay, I got foam on me. I don't know. And I played it. I gave it a good 3 or 4 hour play, or 5 hours even over the weekend, to really give it a shot. Not a fan. Finished Mario. My last one is finished Mario Wonder. It is a wonder. I really enjoyed it. It's another great Mario game. Of course, it's got the Mario name on it. Nintendo doesn't mess around with that, and it is, you know, double thumbs up. I really like it. Maybe not like the best, oh my God, but it is classic Mario. Our buddy Fox said he didn't wasn't really challenged by it, but liked it. I 100% agree. I was not really challenged by it, but I didn't want to be. I think if I would have been challenged, I probably would have stopped and not played more. It just kept. I kept going through the levels and beating the levels and feel like, oh, that was cool and fun and interesting. Go to the next one. I beat all of the worlds and then went to the center and beat Bowser and played his thing, and it was good. And every boss was like the same typical thing. Hit them 3 times on the head and then you beat them. And they do a little bit different thing each time. And the graphics were neat. The story were a little fun. So I really enjoyed it. Had a great time. Would recommend it. I wouldn't, honestly, if I was paying it and PlayStation prices, I wouldn't pay more than $20, $25 for it, because it doesn't feel like one you're going to keep forever, or a $60 huge investment. But it is Mario, so people will pay anything and hold it in the highest regards for whatever reasons. But I really enjoyed it and it was fun.
Nice.
Definitely captures the Mario thing. I rented it from the library, to be full transparent. Which, by the way, if you guys don't know, if in you're in America, you can go to the library and you can rent games. Do it. It's awesome. And I beat it in a week. And I don't play a ton. I played it throughout. So yeah, fun time. Those are my four game reviews things in a quick go.
Nice. Let's see. I had a kind of funny thing. I have no interesting travel anecdotes.
You're back here though, so
I don't think
that's a
I am
cool
back
thing.
here. I'm trying to think what I did. I stayed overnight at Hot Springs National Park in Arkansas. I didn't
Cool. Do you
actually.
actually get to go in the hot springs? Like, or is that like a don't do that 'cause it's
I
nature?
they have a bunch. So the topography and the sort of vibe of the town reminds me a lot of French Lick, Indiana.
Okay, I know that. I know that place.
Which is not surprising. Like, I was driving and I was like, wow, this has big French Lick vibes. But it makes sense that the like landscape, the topography of two places that have hot springs would be similar. But there are a bunch of old bathhouses, right? And they're
Okay.
old, beautiful buildings, like the West Baden Hotel and stuff in French Lick. It's just
Okay.
that there's a row of them, and there's one that's the National Park Visitor Center. It's
Yeah.
weird. It's the first national park I've been to that didn't have like a good parking lot, because it's right downtown next to all these other bathhouses. So I actually had to
Yeah.
park about a block and a half away. But they had a water filling station where this parking lot is, the place that had spots for RVs, because I had the rig because I was moving and I didn't want to unhitch it at the campground. I thought about
Okay.
it because I got there pretty early, but I didn't. I was all, set up and leveled off with the camper still attached to the truck, so I didn't bother with that. But they have a thing with spigots, faucets, and like a push button that you like hold it in, and water, and warm water comes out from, some kind of mineral spring. It's cooled down a little bit, but it's
Okay.
still like 100 degrees.
Yeah.
It's warm enough that I made coffee with. I made instant coffee in my
Huh.
mug, and then filled up
Nice.
my thermos and one of my metal water bottles with hot water that I used to like make coffee for a couple days. And I did something else. I made some tea, and I mean, it tastes like water, right? It's a little, maybe a little more mineral, like getting when I forget why or when this used to be, but when I would buy water at the grocery store, like jugs of water, I years ago. Now I probably wouldn't care about the flavor, taste. Like I drink water at campgrounds that's gone through several filters. I'm not as picky about flavors and stuff as when I was younger. But I used to get spring water as opposed to distilled water because I thought it tasted better. Not as like distilled water can taste a little metallic, because of
I agree.
the boiling process. But the campground was small. It was about, I want to say, like 34 or 35 bucks a night, dollars a night. But they had full RV hookups, with a decent amount of space between sites. There were people there tent camping. A lot of people had fires, and there was a little pile of leftover wood in the fire ring at my site. So I made a little fire and sat out there until it started to get too dark and a little too cold. And it was nice.
Nice.
I got back to Indiana and yesterday went to the BMV. It's BMV in Indiana and DMV in a lot of other states.
Right.
Bureau
Bureau.
of Motor Vehicles as opposed to Department of Motor Vehicles, the same thing.
Right. Right.
And got my new truck registered.
Nice.
And they gave me the temporary plate. I have a paper in the windshield from Nevada where I bought it, that was like a 30-day permit to drive so that I get to my state of residence and get it registered. And this morning I put the temporary plate, which is just paper, right? It's cardstock.
Right.
I had it in my dashboard and I put it on the back of the truck, on the, where the license plate goes. I was like, good, it'll be better if it's back there.
Yeah.
And then I drove to Bloomington today to have salad with our friends Aaron and Chris.
Salad day, right?
As we do, it's Thursday, it's salad day. I said alternate Monday. It's not Wednesday alternate Monday for once. It's a Thursday. But
Weird. Thursday alternate, yeah.
yeah, and then on the way back, I had to get gas, and they had a thing like a car wash, right? And my truck is kind of dirty because I drove 3 days, 2 weeks in a row, and it's been rain, whatever. My truck's dirty. I don't need to explain why. People's cars get
I didn't
dirty.
explain why
It
my truck's
happens.
dirty, but yeah.
And they had a car wash, and I'm like, yeah, I'll do the car wash because it's dirty and whatever. I was mostly concerned with the, I have a vinyl roll-up cover over the bed, and I have
Yeah.
all my stuff, not all my stuff, but a lot of my stuff back there, like my bag of board games. And I'm like, boy, I hope this what I mean, it's supposed to keep out the rain, so like a car wash is probably not gonna hurt it. But then I drove from there all the way back here to my parents' place, which is about like 17 minutes away, 15 to 20 minutes away. And when I parked and got out of the truck, the temporary plate was gone. And I'm like,
Oh my gosh.
oh, it almost certainly, I'm like, maybe it could have blown off, but I'm sure they're designed not to just blow off in the wind. It's a little
Right.
sturdier cardstock than there and than that. But I walked the dog for a minute and then got back in the truck and drove back to that gas station with the car wash. Fortunately, I saw the temporary tag, like soaking wet, folded in half, just outside the car wash. And so I just went up there between the, it's one of those like it's automatic, so only one car fits in at a time, and it's one one that just sprays. Like, it doesn't have any of the flappy rag thing, whatever you call those.
Flappy rag things, I like that.
I'm sure there are terms for those. And I was like, oh, good, that was that was easy. So I got that secured a little bit. I taped it to the dealership card stock that they put in there, and put a one of those plastic frames around it. So I'm like, okay, that's gonna hold. I only need it for a couple of weeks until the real plate comes in the mail. And I'm like, I can't have this blowing off again and get pulled over.
No kidding.
So that was my adventure. Travel
it's
story.
It's nice
for the
that
week.
You finally got all the way back here to get it all registered and taken care of.
I was trying to figure like how I could do that. If I wasn't here, I probably could have done a lot of it online. I don't know if all states do this, but in Indiana, you have to get something called a VIN inspection. I remembered doing that. I don't remember doing it for the Jeep. I do remember doing it for the camper because I had to have a police officer come to my parents' old place and do that inspection there because I didn't take the camper to the BMV.
Yeah.
The one up north is right downtown. There's nowhere I could park a camper anywhere near the BMV. The one in Bedford, I probably could, but anyway, forgot about
an adventure though.
Yeah, I forgot about this. I didn't put it on our list, but I listened to an interesting audiobook. Audiobook. It definitely was an audiobook, but it's a short story. Do you remember the movie I Am Legend?
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Right?
Yeah. With Will Smith? Smith?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that is adapted from a short story that is a horror story about vampires.
Okay, yeah, sure.
Which
I get that.
I did not know. It's been a while since I saw that movie, and I think the movie is a fairly significant departure from the short story.
Okay. I mean, it definitely had vampire. I mean, they didn't call them vampires, but it was like, this is vampire-y vibe.
Okay. I remember them being more like zombies. Which
kind of a cross. They look like zombies, but yes. Vampire quality.
I guess the way in the, I don't know if I should call it a short story. The audiobook was a collection, right? Like half of it is I Am Legend and the rest are much shorter short stories. Like the audio version of them is like 20 minutes. The audio version of I Am Legend was about 5 hours. So, you know, not, it's probably longer than a short story. Maybe novella is the right word, for that. But, it was interesting. I mean, you have the same kind of idea where you're following this guy who believes that he's the last human. There are vampires, but there are like two different kinds. There are like the pure, and you get that sometimes in other vampire mythos, like, you know, here are the true vampires and here are the vampire spawn or whatever. I think the ones that he interacts with most are not completely dead. They're, you know, like dead and undead, but potentially still somewhat human, but, you know, still have the vampire hunger and very difficult to kill unless he stakes them and stuff like that. And then it goes through him finding the dog and eventually meeting a woman. I think all of that stuff is taken out of the movie.
It is. Well, no, there is a woman in the movie.
Okay.
Because there's also like a little kid. But I remember the movie feeling like there's more to this than what's in this film. Right?
So right.
What you're saying makes sense.
Yeah.
That there's other stories or it goes on or something like that. And we're only getting kind of a small
Yeah,
capture of it.
It's the other thing that was interesting about it was that I think it was written in the 70s. And so he's smoking all the time.
okay.
And there's very little, like he has a car that he can drive around that he got working. And he can still pump gas. I'm like, how does he pump gas? Oh, well, in the 70s, they didn't have pay at the pump. They probably still had those like gravity feed gas pumps and stuff. And I forget what kind of car he drove, but it was a brand of car that I've never heard of. Like, oh, that must be long gone, like the Gremlin or AMC or whatever old car brands. But yeah, it's pretty good. I won't give away the ending. And as I said, it's been too long since I saw the Will Smith movie to really compare the two. It's horror, but not like it's horror in the way that vampire zombie stuff is horror. You know, there's a lot of killing and staking, and he spends a long time doing research trying to figure out what causes the vampires, like how they exist. There's no magic. So that was interesting lesson.
I want to rewatch that film occasionally. Again, I say I'm a rewatcher, but that film does a good job of making me not want to watch it because it does give me the feeling of isolation. And that's Will Smith's performance. I remember I don't like that. Anyway, that feeling, maybe it's one of my character flaws or things within my personality, is that isolation and aloneness is something that scares me in a way. You know, the being put into solitary confinement feels like I can entertain myself, but I know that I would not be able to handle that for a long term. And the idea of being the last person on the planet is absolutely terrifying. And Will Smith is in that film is very prepared, but then he sees, you know, he got these monsters and they're truly terrifying monsters. And the director does a good job of getting that across. And this awesome military buff Will Smith has several scenes where he's terrified. He's hiding in a tub with a gun, like just praying for things to get over the night. And I'm like, that's terrifying to me. I don't want to watch that again and experience that. So it does a good job of that I don't want to watch it again, but I kind of want to watch it again because it's really good for that reason. And no, so I'm stuck.
Sure.
I'll bring it back up now. Cause as you're talking about it, I'm like, man, I should put that on. Oh wait, I don't want to put that on. I should put that on. No, I don't want to put that on. You know, it's a good performance. Probably good directing. I will say, I do remember the end having, when they start getting closer to the monsters, it started to look a lot more CGI than the few glimpses.
Sure.
So that was a little
callback. The other thing I wanted to add is you mentioned the library when you played Mario Wonder. I borrowed this audiobook using Libby, which people who are readers know about this, but Libby is one of the apps that you can use. You put your library card number into it.
Oh, yeah.
And it lets you borrow ebooks and audiobooks and some comics, though there's a similar app called Hoopla.
I know Hoopla, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That has more comic stuff. I think the difference between the two is that the catalog of what's available to borrow on Hoopla is consistent. Like, it's just one catalog. Where Libby, the catalog is based on the specific library that you're using. And it has the library thing, like scarcity, which is weird to me. It has to be 100% like contractual, because there's no reason for a fully digital system like that to have limited quantities. But it'll say, you know, if you try to get like the new Sarah J. Maas book, you have to wait, right? Because they've got
yeah
they've got a certain number of copies, quote unquote, and can only be loaned out. You know,
at one time
there's a quantity in there, but they have holds, right? They have waiting lists where you say, oh, we'll put a hold on this, and then the app will just notify you. And what I've found kind of helpful or just different about it compared to Audible is that if I borrow a book, an audiobook using Libby, I have 21 days before I have to return it. Now, I think I've done this once or twice, so I don't know how it is affected by people having holds on it, but you can extend that just like you could do with the library, right? If you have a book, you have it for too long, you could call them and say renew the loan kind of thing. But for most audiobooks, especially something like this one that's only 5 hours, I can easily get through that in much less than 3 weeks, right? Like usually a couple days. But having that timer on it gives me that little extra push to keep listening to it when I open my phone. I'm like, what do I want to listen to? One of my Audible books? Do I want to listen to a podcast? I'm like, oh, I've only got 2 weeks left on this Libby loan. I'll listen to that, you know, first.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is cool.
The library is underrated. It's gotten, we might have mentioned this a couple times before, but it's always worth singing the praises of, you know, that's an organization in America. And I know we're just speaking with our experiences of American things, and it's different from state to state for sure.
Right.
But so I can guess I speak to Indiana's thing. And I've been to the New York libraries, and they're also fantastic as well. In DC. DC has some great libraries I went to. They are a thing like the newspaper that could have gone under, and the newspaper hasn't gone under yet, but could completely be a thing of the past that technology has just usurped. But they pivoted and have changed and still maintained to be a part of the community, offering things to those who can't, you know, get them necessarily on their own. I can't always go out and when I was younger and buy all of the Encyclopedia Britannica books, but I could go to the library and actually read them as a kid. And let me tell you, as a poor kid, being able to go through all the African animals was such a really cool thing, where some people would be able to have them at home. Not everyone in our communities can have the internet and get audiobooks for $40 to $60 a book, you know,
right.
Or have an Audible subscription. They can't afford that kind of a thing,
yeah.
But the library gives us those kind of opportunities.
Yeah.
They can't afford marketing, right? They're doing the best they can what they got.
Right.
But here you and I can be a little bit of marketing to that. Go out there, guys. Check your library out. Those fine, wonderful people giving you fine, amazing products, and not just books, audiobooks, music, CDs, games, comic books.
Yeah.
Tons of really great stuff for free in the community. And we're really fortunate to have that.
Funny anecdote about encyclopedias. We had a set, I'm sure my parents still have it. I don't think they were world. I mean, there were world books. That was a specific thing, or that were like by year, like all the interesting things in a year, so they could publish new without updating the whole encyclopedia. I don't know if those were the ones we had, but we got them. You know, a guy came, right, with the box with a, you know, door to door salesman, right, the 80s,
yeah.
And. My grandparents had a set that I think theirs were the World Book ones. And my cousin came over one time to use them because, she didn't have a set. And the encyclopedias my grandparents had 48 states. They were printed before Hawaii and Alaska were added as states to the country. And so
that's awesome.
I think in one of them, grandma had like written in with pen, like this state in this year and this state in this year. which is a funny, like, it's weird to think about now because we don't have, I mean, we still have books, but all the things, maybe not all, but the things people use for reference are online. They're updated constantly, like within days. You wouldn't go on Wikipedia and find information that's 30, 40 years out of date, right?
Funny thing. It's totally true. I mean, I the things I learned in the encyclopedia, again, you get elephants, and an elephant has billions of pages on what elephants are now, but in the encyclopedia, it would just be like three paragraphs and everything that there is, and that's all we do ever know, and it's outdated next week, you know, but we wouldn't know that. It's just different times and stuff.
This is a funny...
48 states, that's kind of cool.
Yeah. You've seen the, and maybe I've sent it to you, there's a channel, I think they're on YouTube, but I see their stuff on TikTok, of a father and daughter just like podcasting. They're just talking, and the clips that show up on TikTok are him explaining something to her that she doesn't understand, because she's too young. She's, I don't know, probably like 17.
Like a rotary phone.
A rotary phone or a record player, like, him like walking her through turning on a turntable and putting the needle on and like explaining how the sound, like you can hear the sound on the needle and stuff like that, was pretty cool. But this one is, he's trying to explain encyclopedias, and he's like, you go to the library and you find these books, and she's like, so did they have, like, did the index have questions? Like, if you had a question, you could do. And what was interesting to me about that is that there's a kind of, and I don't think this way, maybe it's generational, maybe it's just, you know, working in IT. I almost never, like, I played around with ChatGPT last week and I asked it questions. But if I go on a search engine, if I go on Google or DuckDuckGo or something, I don't phrase what I want in a question. Right? I just right. slap the keywords together. I'm like, this program, Jeep Grand Cherokee engine light or whatever. Like, I just put the keywords together because I know that it doesn't, I'm not talking to a person. I don't have to phrase it as a question like I'm on Jeopardy. But for her, she's just like, you go on Google and you're like, what's the fastest animal? I don't know. Types But it's just funny to me that her first thought was, you use an encyclopedia as if you're asking it questions and it can answer. I'm like, it's a book. You would, you know, if you go and ask a librarian, like, what's the capital of Syria or whatever, that makes more sense. But just a funny, like, way that people's minds work.
Right.
All right.
Goodness.
We're all out of time.
I think so. Yeah, we've made it over there. Well, I'm looking forward to starting tomorrow our game weekend.
Yeah, we'll have game weekend, so we'll have
haven't even been able to see you yet, so it'd be nice to play some games this year.
And we didn't talk about Ticket to Ride either, though we talked about that a couple weeks ago when I played it before. I don't have too many new thoughts on it.
We'll have to try some new games, maybe some old games.
We'll have new games and I haven't played together. No movie this week, because we watched two last week, and we're going to be recording again in like four days, and three of those are going to be chock full of gaming. I mean, unless we want to talk about probably Big Lebowski and Snatch.
Snatch again.
No.
King Arthur movies. Yes.
Yeah, right. Legend
and Excalibur.
Right? Excalibur. That's it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you've been listening to The Front Porch. This is episode 338. Thanks always to our friends at LRM Online. You can check them out. Our buddy Fox already has a review up for Dune Part 2, mm-hmm. Electric Boogaloo, whatever it's called.
Nice.
If you want to reach out to us and tell us how misogynist we are for objectifying Sydney Sweeney, you can do that email. Our address is front porch. I mean, I'll save you the time. We did, and we're sorry.
We did.
Our email address is frontporchpod@gmail.com, or you can go to our website, frontporchpodcast.com, to find contact forms. And I put links in the show notes to, I think, everything that we talked about this week. If you enjoy The Front Porch, please consider subscribing on the podcatcher of your choice. And while you're there, if you leave us a 5-star review, we always appreciate that. It helps out a lot in the rankings. As always, thanks so much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Dennis.
And I'm Michael.
For The Front Porch.
Night, everybody.
See you next time.